it's always right on spot. And we're going to hear from the Lottery Commission and a little bit on InfoTech. Appreciate those people who have heard this before, sticking around at least for a little bit. That's very kind, and hopefully we're getting a good dose of information to get us prepared for making some tough decisions this next session. So with that, no further ado, I'll ask Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Beck to come up and give us a whirlwind tour of our economic and revenue outlook. And of course, the March forecast.
Chair Schroeder and the members of the committee. My name is Dave Beck, acting state economist. Here with me is Michael Kennedy, our senior economist from the Office of Economic Analysis. Here, we appreciate the opportunity to present to you our outlook, our view on Oregon's economic and revenue. In terms of economic outlook, we're going to take a look at December forecast again and see what has happened since then. In particular, we're going to look at employment growth in the fourth quarter and the leading economic indicators. Two of the biggest uncertainties surrounding our economy are housing sector and inflation pressure. So we're going to take a close look at these two factors. On top of these two uncertainties, we have plenty of downside risk surrounding our economy, so we're going to take a closer look at them as time allows. This is a review of our December 2006 forecast. We had good years, 2005 and 2006. In 2006, the latest figure shows that we had 3.2% employment growth. But a huge chunk of jobs were created in the first half. We saw a significant deceleration in job growth in the second half of the year. Looking ahead this year, we're going to see 1.2% growth, which is sluggish compared to the past 3 years. Before we get closer to trend growth of 1.5-1.6% growth in later years. Personal income growth will follow similar pattern. We're going to see a little slow growth in 2007, and we're going to recover in 2008 and 2009. Now, this is a comparison among our three different forecasts. Now, at this point, there's no indication that we have to change our baseline scenario. Our baseline scenario is strong 2006, but weaker 2007, before we move closer to trend growth in 2008 and 2009. We do have pessimistic scenario when our downside risks come to reality. We may see a slight job loss in 2007. And we'll be still recovering from it in 2008 and 2009. Now, what has happened since we put out our December forecast? What we see these days is very much consistent with our outlook that we put out in December 2006. We see a substantial deceleration in job growth. And by the way, in the fourth quarter, we saw positive 0.3% growth. The slide looks a little deceiving. It's positive growth. We didn't lose jobs, although in December we saw some job decline. But overall, in the fourth quarter, we saw a small job gains. Now, if you look into our details, we still have strong construction sector. The strength doesn't come from housing sector, rather it comes from non-residential sector. We have office projects going on, industrial projects going on, and we have public projects, roads and bridges in particular. Initial unemployment benefit claims are running a little bit higher than last year, We're looking very closely, we're tracking this thing very closely because it's one of the leading indicators. If you look at income side, personal income is growing robust. Wages and salaries are growing nicely. And personal income tax withholding is in line with our forecast. Without getting into technical details, what the leading economic indicators for both the U.S. and Oregon tell us is that we're going to have slower growth in 2007 in particular. Biggest drags, and of course, housing permits and initial unemployment benefit claims. We see some positives coming from stocks and real money supply, and if you look at the stock market, you don't even see even a slight slowdown coming. It's registering record highs every day. This slide shows our Oregon index of leading economic indicators, and the solid line shows slight negative at this point, and that's the leading indicator. And the thin line is employment growth, a six-month moving average. What does this leading indicator tell us? It tells us that the growth will be slow, but we're not going to see a recession at this point. Two of the biggest uncertainties that I mentioned in the beginning, one of them was housing permits and housing sectors, rather. We have shrinking housing permits. There's no question that there is a very serious housing correction going on at the national level and in Oregon too. Luckily, so far we have limited spillover effects coming from housing sector. In Oregon, year-to-date building permits through November is down over 13%. And that's going to be translated into lower housing starts later on. So that's the first act of housing slowdown. What's the second act coming from it? Well, we lost jobs in the residential construction sector. And what we see is some of the housing-related industries losing jobs. Manufacturing, wood product, is weak at this point, and consistent with consumers cutting back on spending, we see a small decline in jobs in retail sectors. And because of housing slowdown, what we see is a shrinking mortgage equity withdrawal. There's less cash out refinancing, and that's going to slow our consumer spending. Now, in Oregon, we have lower home sales, but interestingly enough, our median sales price of existing single family homes keeps rising at this point. The second biggest uncertainty is inflation pressure. Overall, we have balance in upward pressure and downward pressure.
So inflation pressure is
moderating at this point. And it's we consider that inflation pressure will not threaten the current expansion. So overall, what we see is the Goldilocks economy, which is not too hot and not too cold. Last time we talked about the Goldilocks economy was 2000, and the story ended tragically. And what we think at this point is The economy will expand, but expansion will be painfully slow. The reason for this view about not too cold or not too hot economy is that housing market will hit bottom in 2007. We're seeing nascent signs that the housing sector actually is hitting the bottom. For example, housing starts went up, home sales are improving, and builders' sentiment is improving. So our guess is housing sector will hit bottom in the first half before recovering in the second half of the year. The consumer spending is slowing because of cooling housing market, but at the same time it's being sustained by rising real income. Business investment has firm support. Of course, business firms are sitting on huge cash reserves. Their profit levels are high. And as soon as there is a sign that demand is picking up, they're ready to spend. And Oregon's economy will benefit from it. Dollar depreciation will boost our exports. And we have huge presence of manufacturing sector, higher than the national average, so we'll benefit from that too. Inflation pressure is almost cresting, at least moderating, and our national forecast provider Global Insight thinks that there will be 3 rate cuts. So the current Fed funds rate is 5.25%, but it's going to go down to 4.50, so 75 basis point decline. All in all, we should expect a little trend growth at the national level. Trend growth is 3% GDP growth, but in our state, we look at employment growth. We see 1.5, 1.6 as trend growth at this point, but we are going to see 1.2% growth, which is below trend. If I say that we can handle improving situations pretty well, not many would disagree, but what we have to ask is this: are we prepared for worst case scenario? The reality may come in between the baseline and the worst case scenario. But, so I feel compelled to talk about downside risk. And of course, if you make the opposite assumptions on these lists, you'll come up with an optimistic scenario. So what are the downside risks? We have rising labor costs at this point, and that pushes down productivity growth. So the cost of production may rise. There may be a deeper housing downturn. And at this point, crude oil price is hovering at about 50, but there is always a chance that oil prices will shoot up. Now, what that means is we may see a higher inflation. Then the Fed guys are watchful, and they're going to start jacking up the interest rate, hurting the economy. Now, foreign investors may lose confidence in dollars, dumping dollars, and that may lead to weak dollar, and import prices will go up, and we're going to see higher interest rate. The foreigners are not providing money for us to spend. Now, there is always a chance that geopolitical tension intensifies. And all this happening together will hurt consumer confidence, and consumer spending will decline. And all this happens, we're going to go into a recession-like situation. Now, I mentioned in the beginning that the current developments are consistent with our baseline scenario. So we are not changing our baseline scenario. Baseline scenario is that we're going to slow down in 2007, but we're going to recover to trend growth in 2008 and 2009. I am done with economic side presentation. If you have any questions, I can entertain them.
Are there questions for Mr. Beckman?
Yes, President Bunner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little confused, and it may simply be that I'm having difficulty dealing with terms. On the one hand, you indicate, and I'm back a couple of slides, I think, a decrease in the dollar depreciation will boost exports, you indicate. But, of course, we also have a large number of imports, things that we buy from other countries. Do you expect businesses in those countries simply to absorb the loss generated by the increasing weakness in the dollar, or how is that going to affect inflation?
Chair Schrader and Representative Bonhart, this is what it happens when the dollar depreciates too quickly. What happens, if it is an orderly depreciation, then our economy and foreign economies will handle the situation rather smoothly. But if dollar depreciates, loses its value very quickly, then this is what it happens. These Asian economies in particular cannot sell their products in our market, because if dollar depreciates, then their currency becomes very, very strong. And what that means is their export price to us goes up sharply, and we don't like it, so American consumers will not buy. So then these Asian countries, for example, are big importers of our products, and they can't buy our products. That's going to hurt our manufacturing side, and it's going to have spillover effects. That's our manufacturing and its spillover effect. On the other hand, because we have to buy more expensive imports, then that's going to put the pressure on our price level. So that's going to lead to inflation. So that's how the economy responds to a sharp depreciation of the dollar. I mean, if it is an orderly depreciation, then our manufacturing will benefit by selling more, and then foreign countries will respond to this slow and gradual depreciation. But if the transition occurs rather quickly, then that's when disruption occurs.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Beck, what's your guidance regarding unemployment benefit claims? You know that they're higher year over year. Should we assume that they continue to climb relative to 2006, or do they even out given your given the expected growth in employment in the second half of the year?
Chair Schrader and Representative Edwards, we've been tracking this unemployment benefit claims very closely since November, because we saw an unusually large jump. And what we see at this point is slightly higher than last year. November was bad, but if that trend continued in December, then we would have really worried. But at this point, December over December is about the same. The weakness came from November, unusually a weak November. So what happens is, as we go into the second half of 2007, the things will improve, And as a result, we anticipate an unemployment benefit claims about the same as last year, or even if the economy improves further, then perhaps we could see a little decline in that.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Comment on slide 4, where you have that little graph about the leading indicators. You can't help but notice that, you know, the graph that we're seeing right now from 05, 06, and 07 looks a lot like 2000 going into 2001. So an obvious question would be, what is different about the indicators, you know, this last year versus 2000, 2001? If I was to go back to the forecast 6-7 years ago, I'm hoping I wouldn't read the same stuff that y'all are telling me right now.
Sure, Schroeder. In fact, this leading indicator has been gradually declining, and now at 6 months moving average shows slightly negative signs. If you go back to 2000, and the movement of this leading indicator was a sharp decline, really sharp decline. But if you look at the movement from 2004, it's a gradual decline. And up until 3-4 months ago, this indicator still was positive. So what we saw is an employment gains very consistent with this leading economic indicator. What we see about two quarters from now, perhaps we'll be seeing a small gain in jobs, not spectacular at all. Spectacular job gains in 2005 and 6 is consistent with very high levels of leading indicators.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, one follow-up to your question.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Beck. Do you expect the job growth to occur in sectors that typically provide family or living wage jobs?
Chair Schroeder and Representative Edwards, that's been my concern. The global competition is such that nation as a whole, and Oregon in particular, are losing manufacturing jobs. We know that manufacturing jobs are high-paying jobs. We're losing these jobs, and we're we're creating jobs in retail sectors and in the sectors, service sectors that are not paying real high wages. Can we reverse that trend? My answer, or my guess, is no. The manufacturing sector is losing jobs for many, many different reasons, but one of the reasons why we're losing manufacturing jobs is, of course, growing competition. But at the same time, manufacturing sector is very, very highly efficient, which means that we need less of pure labor. So the jobs are being created in areas where wages are typically low at this point, and that's why Oregon as a whole is not closing the gap against the average of the country. Mm-hmm. So in per capita terms, we're at about 92-93% of national average, and in terms of wages, we're about the same percentage. Mm-hmm. So it is a concern that jobs are being created in an area where typically wages are not high enough.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Kennedy.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee,
Michael Kennedy,
Senior Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. Let me go find my name here. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the current biennial forecast, just because there are a couple of issues I think we need to look at that have great bearing on our projections for the next biennium, and then I'll move on to the 0709 forecast of revenues, which is more pertinent to this body, and then talk about lottery for a moment. First table here looks at the current biennial forecast, which has now been out for a month and a half, and it's no great surprise. We're looking at about $12.7 billion projected for revenues this biennium. The two points I want to make here, one, looking at the second column, I think it's widely known but bears repeating, 87% of our revenues coming from personal income tax, another 6% coming from corporate income tax. That is far and away this single greatest reliance of any state on a single source of income, and the income itself happens to be one of the more volatile sources, so it just, I'm sure you all are aware of this, but it's good to reinforce. The second point here, looking at the third column, are percentage changes from the prior biennium. We see the personal income tax has increased 23% from the last biennium. That compares to a long-term average of about 12%, so fairly extraordinary. Matter of fact, it's unprecedented growth in the last quarter decade, even looking at the 90s. Corporate income tax, 21% growth, but if you factor back in the $135 million kicker credits that are being taken this year, you're actually looking at structural growth of about 42%. Compare that to long-term averages of about 11%. So both have performed exceptionally well. So overall, revenues have grown significantly above the long-term 12% average. We're looking at about 23% structural revenue growth. And as we've gone along in the last year and a half and looking at this exceptional growth, the question is, what's really driving this? And in particular, to what degree are these factors temporary and or permanent? And one of the major obstacles we face there in really getting to the underlying factors are these long data lags between when the revenues come in and then when we get the tax returns. And in some cases, there isn't even data to really get at the core of what these factors are, due to the fact that, in particular, the Department of Revenue here doesn't really need to collect detailed information behind income sources, because we start with federal AGI. That's where our compliance efforts start. So really, it's the IRS that has the detailed information, and there's a lot of issues there about getting that information and making these inferences. So we have to make certain assumptions about the drivers for the increases in revenues we're seeing. And we've really changed two major assumptions that have gone into the major increases we've seen in the projection for revenues. They concern capital gains for the personal income tax and U.S. corporate profits for the corporate income tax. So starting with capital gains, I would say this is probably the most important slide or the image to take away from this presentation. What we're looking at here are net taxable capital gains on full-year resident tax returns over time. You can see the impact of the 90s, the stock market boom, telecom, high-tech stocks, and it is important to point out that at this point in time, there was a major discussion about sort of the real or Memorex nature of this major jump in stock market gains. And at the time, there were a lot of rationales about, well, computerization and telecom, these things are really changing the productivity of the American workforce and the American firm. And about the time we bought into this as a real permanent level shift to a new paradigm, the floor fell out. And so, you know, basically, we were taught the lesson that if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. Now, for a few years, capital gains hovered around $3 billion. And in the most recent years, we've seen an incredible jump again, even more larger increases over this two-year period than we saw in the 90s. It bears pointing out as well that this 2005 figure there is a forecast. So 2 years ago, and we were still projecting that that will be what in fact happened in 2005. 2 weeks from now, we'll actually get the 2005 tax data and actually know what that number is. But given the incredible increases in personal income tax, we really only have two culprits that you can point to, and that's capital gains and small business income, Schedule E income, that have the volatility historically to be able to really be fueling the kind of gains in personal income tax we're seeing. So the important point here is that back in May 2005, here was our forecast. At that point, we had 2003 data, and we projected a modest recovery in gains and then, you know, routine increases thereafter. This is now the forecast underlying the December forecast. And what has changed over that year and a half is really into assuming what portion of this is temporary and what portion of this is a permanent increase in long-term levels of capital gains. And the reason why we've shifted now towards more permanence is that the sort of the temporary factors that we thought might be driving these up, in particular real estate gains, appear to be having very little effect or have very little appearance in taxable capital gains for various reasons. So now basically the scenario is that these really represent the exhaustion of a lot of losses that were generated in 2001. When those losses go away, we're now seeing true real levels of gross taxable capital gains feeding through to tax returns and being taxed. So that's, but it's a major assumption, and it just is important to remember how similar this current rationale is of permanence to the, you know, sort of the things that were being said back here. So it's a downside risk, but still this forecast is based on current information and advice from our tax advisors. So it is the baseline of most likely scenario, but it has large downside risks should that, so basically the rationale, prove false. A very similar story here with U.S. corporate profits. Again, you have the history. This is U.S. profits, but obviously those then get apportioned down to Oregon and taxed here as taxable income. You can see the significant change in the outlook from May 2005 to the current. It's still incredible increases, but really they've been unprecedented in the last 2 years, last 3 years. Almost more than a doubling from the previous peak in the 90s of corporate profits from $800 billion to $1.8 trillion. And the question remains there as well when you see these extraordinary increases. How much of this is temporary? How much is this permanent? Again, similar rationales going on there, that there's very little to point to in the way of sort of temporary factors. The only one you can really point to is oil prices. They spike, and you heard about record Exxon profits. But at the Oregon level, there is very little that filters down through here. We have little gas and oil mining here. So really the permanent rationales, the permanent assumptions are dominating in the forecast, and you've seen the effects of those, which are rising long-term revenue increases in the forecast. Well known what the December forecast is, just to reiterate, about $13 billion in resources for this biennium, $1.4 billion above the closing session forecast, reflective of that extraordinary unanticipated growth. How things are tracking since the December forecast, actually for the first time in a long time, the PIT collections forecast, or actual collections, are tracking slightly below the forecast. So this may be an indication that we've finally assimilated, you know, those phenomenal growth factors into the model, and things appear to be tracking much better now. Corp collections are still tracking above forecast. However, there's a serious question about the validity or the realness of the payments they're making. Payments are currently 20% up year over year, yet you have an 05 tax return with a 36% credit deduction on it. So there's a lot of issues with sort of the timing of when firms realize true changes in their liability and when they adjust. And so we may actually just be seeing sort of momentum. Eventually they're going to wake up and realize, gee, we really don't owe all this money, and refunds will kick up. But that is actually currently factored into our forecast, but yet still payments are resisting what should be sort of a slowdown in collection patterns. When you take this all combined total, there's really little indication of any major forecast changes in the near future, given what we're currently seeing. In the future, to look at the 0709 forecast, carry forward balance from the current biennium of $1.4 billion. Our structural revenue growth, this is what we would have if there were no kicker, is about $14 billion. We'll be distributing a projected $1.4 billion in personal and corporate kicker credits, so you have a total resource projection for next biennium of about $14 billion. So that's our baseline forecast for next biennium. Now, in terms of risk to that forecast, the first one we'll look at is what we're terming a fiscal recession. And what we mean by that is, if in fact capital gains increases recently are more temporary than permanent. We need to see a correction there. In fact, those U.S. corporate profits aren't really at sustainable levels, and you see a correction there. You could see declining general fund revenues in Oregon, even as you looked out to the economy and saw employment still growing, wages still growing. And that's because most of the volatility in our revenue is the result of decisions and or incomes earned at the very high level of the income distribution for individuals and among a very few firms. And you can see major corrections there even as, you know, the economy looks like it's doing fine. So turn that sort of those particular issues we've discussed, tack onto that all of the, sort of the worst case scenario recessionary aspects in the economy that Dave has talked about. And if you run all of that and you come up with a worst case scenario, you can get to about $1.5 billion below the current baseline projection of $14 billion. So that's really sort of the confidence interval on the downside. On the upside, sort of the confidence interval is compressed because when you say, well, what's the best case scenario? Well, we're kind of living it right now. 4 years ago, if you'd said what would be the best case scenario, you still would have never imagined 23% growth in general funds. So we're kind of sort of up there. Still is the baseline scenario, it's the most probable, but sort of the probability of being 10% above that is much smaller than the probability you might be 10% below that. Just asymmetric. I was asked to touch on 09-11 for a moment. We're looking at basically structural revenue growth of about 11% general fund in 09-11 once you adjust out for the fact that you distributed $1.4 billion in kickers in the previous biennium. Add to that, that's about $15.5 billion in general fund revenues. Add on top of that $1.4 billion for lottery, and you're at about $16.9 billion, which would constitute roughly a 13% increase in resources relative to our projection for 07-09. In terms of the lottery forecast, I know a few members here have seen this before, members from the Revenue Senate and the Revenue or House Revenue Committees. This is the year-over-year growth in video lottery sales. And as you can see, starting in about May 2005, as line games are implemented, year-over-year growth in sales continue to climb and peaked at about 34% year-over-year growth in spring of 06. Now, as we got to May of 06, June of 06, you started to compare line game sales to line game sales prior, and you would expect that growth rate to then fall down to normal long-term levels, roughly 6%. And that's what seemed to be happening until about July of 2006. Then it reversed course and persisted above 20% for a number of months. And that was due to a number of factors. Lottery continued to invest in new machines, continued to upgrade the games themselves that players like to play. So there were reasons for this persistence, but that's why basically we've had recent increases in the lottery forecast. Currently, we'll just look at the current December forecast for resources, just cracking $1 billion, as has been noted publicly. For the next biennium, we're currently projecting $1.3 billion in available resources, roughly a 14% increase over the current biennium. And recent tracking, actually for the first time in a long time, the video sales forecast is actually tracking almost identical to actual sales. So we appear to have finally factored in the impact of line games into the model itself and expect that in the future the forecast will perform a lot more accurately than it has during this sort of tumultuous period with the implementation of line games.
Questions for Mr. Kennedy? Representative Edwards.
What's the anticipated variance or differential between actual and anticipated video lottery sales, given the new model?
Chair Schrader, Representative Edwards, I'm not, you mean the potential variation around the forecast?
Mm-hmm.
We strive, it's a sort of a internal performance measure of 2% up or down. Over the long run, obviously, we're not even come close to getting within that range.
What's the historical differential?
Chair Schrader, Representative Edwards, prior to the implementation of line games, there was probably still a 4 to 5% downside error, basically residuals in the way it was they were forecasting. We used to use just a straight trend variable, and it was really subject to a lot of forecaster judgment. We refined the model to tie those sales to overall consumption, and basically remodel it as a subset of entertainment consumption. And that variable is actually, it fits very well historically and should provide for a better and more rationalized expectation of future sales growth.
We're in the library anymore. Other questions? Thank you both very much. Appreciate the update. I hope you're right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Too.
Ben, please come forward, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I apologize to those of you who have heard me a couple of times in other committees. But it is my goal to give you a brief overview of the lottery and certainly to answer any questions that you may have. I have prepared a handout for you, which hopefully you're receiving now. Just starting out, making the point that gambling is one of those controversial issues that people have personal opinions about. It's not the goal of the lottery to convince people one way or the other about gambling. This is a policy choice that the voters made. And so it is our job to simply implement what the voters have requested. And so I detailed on the first page some constitutional amendments that were developed by the voters in the past. And setting up the lottery and setting up the Lottery Commission as the overseer in operations and spending and budgets for that lottery. Over the years, that has been changed by the voters, where those dollars will go. I will simply, the last point there being that there was a vote in, I guess, 22 years ago to begin the lottery. It passed by 66%. We do try to track as one of our performance measures favorability by the public, and our last data point was 63% just last week. If I move into the next page, it simply gives the organizational structure. The governor appoints members of the commission. The Senate must confirm members of the commission. By law, one commissioner must be a CPA and is in charge of our audit committee. By law, one commissioner must be a law enforcement officer and is a retired sheriff at present time. We have one vacancy, but we also have an executive vice president for Harry and David, and we have a lawyer from Portland who is the chair at the present time. An assistant director for security by law must be a law enforcement officer, a person with experience in law enforcement. Our mission statement really focuses on two things: the integrity and security of the system and the games to earn maximum profits for the people of Oregon, commensurate with the public good. The public good to us involves several things. First of all, obviously the programs that these dollars go to are certainly helpful to the public, whether it's education, habitat, development, economic development, or parks. But to us, this also is something that means that we should be responsible, even as a sales organization, dealing with problem gambling and responsible gambling. And so those are goals that we set for ourselves as well. Security, I think, is extremely important, because if the public loses faith in the integrity or security of the lottery, the game process itself, the agency itself, then you don't have a product to sell. And so we must protect that, and that's one of our major goals. In page four, I try to give you a quick overview of our budget process, in that it is a yearly budget, and the commission has just adopted our latest strategic plan that is given out to the organization. We develop business plans and projects to fulfill that strategic vision. We have a financial plan, and that is reported on monthly. Measurements are developed from that plan, ultimately, and it is provided to the governor's office for comment. Ultimately, the commission adopts a budget usually in June for the upcoming fiscal year, and copies of that are provided to the governor, legislative fiscal officer, and legislative revenue officer. Page 5 is really what you just heard a presentation about, and is really what you're probably most concerned about. The goal and the reason for the Oregon Lottery is to produce revenue for state programs. And this just identifies the growth in those transfers in the past few years. If you add fiscal year 2006, which is when we closed the books on that year, the projection for 2007, that gives you the $1.026 billion transfer that Mr. Kenny was talking about. You look forward and you'll see numbers. These are actual transfers. It doesn't include some interest dollars and some carryover that would give you the final figures that he was actually mentioning. They're a little bit higher, but this is actual earned income, profits, whatever, as a transfer to the state. I'll make the note that the lottery has been in existence for about 21 years, and you can see that over that 21-year history, we have transferred $4.6 billion, or a little more, to state programs. And yet, you can see in the last few years, the lottery has grown dramatically, so that now, every 2 years, we'll be adding over $1 billion to that $4.6 billion. So it has increased. The next page, I really won't talk about. This is really your business, how you spend the money, where it goes. All I'll simply say is revenue bonds is one of those purposes that you designated in the past. I'm sure you'll talk about this session. Page 7, try to highlight. I know that I read in today's Oregonian that you had a presentation, I think yesterday, about bonding authority and the level of bonding review by agencies. And yet, at the end of that article, it talks about the one bright spot for Oregon is the lottery-backed bonds. And this slide really tries to bring that forward. In just the last 2 months, the two of the three rating agencies have increased their rating of lottery-backed bonds. Standard & Poor's has raised it to the highest, and Moody's has upgraded our bonds, and light rail lottery-backed bonds have been upgraded to their highest measure. So that's a positive thing, and one note I will make about it, I think it is a stable funding source for you to use for bonding, and historically it does not seem to have been affected by recessionary trends. Move forward to the next page, talking about, again, since integrity and security of the lottery is very important, the audit history of the lottery is also important. I just received notice from the Secretary of State. We have a yearly financial audit, and again in 2006, as in several other years, we have no material findings in that financial audit. The security review by statute, we have to have an outside security review every 2 years, and you can see the note here from the last one, or really the last two, talking about that the lottery security meets or exceeds the best practices of state lotteries. We have a very active audit committee of the commission and an aggressive internal audit program as well. I receive questions from time to time about the contingency reserve of the lottery, and that's on page 9. I simply highlight for you that the lottery must be self-supporting. We cannot borrow money. You cannot loan us money. We have to pay our freight. And so the mechanism that is used to actually allow us to do that is the Lottery Commission has set a contingency reserve. It contains assets, many of them are buildings, are machines, those are not liquid assets, but we maintain a maximum of a $45 million cash contingency reserve. $20 million of that is really our checkbook and keeps our bills moving forward and being able to pay the obligations that we have. And we do allow that to go up to a cap of $45 million as a reserve in case we have a downturn in sales or something happens, we have a breakdown of equipment, whatever, that we are able to continue to transfer dollars as they are projected. It is not a large reserve, though. It's $25 million, as I've stated, and you can see that we are projected to transfer $1.25 billion. So that's about a 2% reserve available for us. I mentioned on page 10, again, just to highlight really key performance measures, and these involve several different things, but the bottom line for the lottery is how much money is transferred. That's really the reason for the lottery. And so the forecast in our last year projected $446 million. We were able to exceed that and produce $531. We do try to track the favorability by citizens in Oregon. This was their creation. We want to have a popular product that they support, and so we do track that favorability. We also track our administrative expenses, trying to keep them low because that impacts our transfer capability. On page 11, we have begun keeping key customer service measures at your direction, and this just shows our last year's performance on those. I want to move to page 12, however, because one question I've gotten in each of these committees usually relates to the commissions that are paid to video retailers. And so let me kind of give you a quick overview of that. 3 years ago, if we were talking about this subject, about if I owned a bar, a restaurant, a tavern, and I had video lottery in my establishment, what would I receive for this? And 3 years ago, I would receive 32% of the net return on that operation. In 2004, that contract ran out. And so there was a new contract developed, and I'm going to say that we have different tiers of commission rates and different options, but I'm just going to, for sake of simplicity, roll them all together and say a blended rate of all sales of all retailers over that year. That's what I'm going to talk about. That's the number I'm going to use. 2004, that number was 28.5. And then I, in 2005, been here 2 years. The request was made for $120 million of additional revenue and to use line games to develop that. We put an amendment to this contract, created a new contract, and said then the blended commission rate will drop to 25% because sales are going to go up. We projected that they would be 27%. Obviously, you've heard today that they've been closer to 43-44% in that two-year period. Something that didn't receive a lot of publicity at the time, but was adopted by the commission at the same time that it created this new 25% rate, it said, you know, these are projections, and we don't know what's really going to happen. We had some people telling us our sales would go down. We had other people telling us our sales would go up more than 100%. So, we're going to establish 25%, but in June 2007, we're going to look and see what is the actual amount of sales for video in June 2007. And if those sales are above $805 million, which would have been a 40% increase from June 2005, then we are automatically going to reduce the commission rate down to about 23% blended rate. The December forecast established that our sales for June 2007 should be $836 million. That's obviously quite a bit above the 805. I've spent the last 2 years trying to build a better relationship with our retailer base. and I think have been somewhat successful. They are not happy about this. They weren't happy about the 25%. But we've been able to keep them on board. And the point that I will make in the written portion of this page is that we were able to not only produce the $120 million, plus reduce commission rates and make arrangements for greatly increased sales to reduce them farther to 23%. But we also maintain an active, healthy retailer network that, in effect, is our sales force for the video product. And we were able to produce and will produce $195 million to be precise, above the end of session forecast when we left the last legislative session. So not only were we able to reduce commission rates, we were also able to greatly increase sales and transfers, $200 million. So we think that has worked out well. That increase is what enabled you, if you were in the last session, in the special session, to be able to present the $42 million back to education. That was because of increased lottery and primarily video lottery growth during that time. We will have another opportunity in 2010 at the close of this contract to revisit this issue, but I will tell you the point of 23% and the other point being that our scales, the more you sell, the lower the commission rate gets. We actually get out to levels of 8% at high sales rate. So this actually will keep going down gradually till 2010. But the discussion usually has focused around the idea that Canada is an appropriate model for us. Their commission rates are 15 to 22. But I think in 2010 we will be right in that Canadian rate. We probably will be low 22 at that point. But that's just information about that. Let me move to the last slide. I'll talk about very quickly and answer any of the questions you might have. I've tried to present for you some challenges that we face. Just as you've heard the economists say, these are the risks that we have in our forecast. We have some challenges. They are stretching us out, quite frankly. I'll say it that way. When he said that his model is finally predicting sales, the last 3 weeks we have not made the projection. If you look over the last 11 weeks of the new projection, now we have made the projection, but I think we've hit his goal that he wants to be 50% above and 50% below, but end up right in the middle. But it is going to cause me to have some gray hair, I think, in this process. But we will lose a game here very quickly, sports action and scoreboard. The only reason I bring that forward, again, all of these things is not to talk about policy. Policy isn't my issue. I'm just talking about forecast. Our traditional product, even though our video product has been growing very well, our traditional product is flattening. And that's a nationwide issue. And so when we talk about ticket sales, which has always been the strength of the lottery, and Powerball and Megabucks and these other games, they are beginning to flatten. Powerball is the one game that has really helped us set new records. And by the way, $205 million. You can't win unless you buy a ticket on Powerball. But our traditional product is flattening. And so we are going to lose a bit of our traditional product base here. I look forward, and again, not a comment on smoking ban. You will have legislation in front of you. The governor strongly supports it. But a smoking ban will impact our sales. I can't tell you how much or how long, but it will be a challenge for us. I believe that we can make that $1.25 billion projection, but that is one of those. Casinos is another issue. And the two that I will mention is the Center Casino in Washington. I saw an article this week in the Oregonian talking about that there should be a decision, maybe as soon as this spring, on whether or not there will be a tribal casino in the center. 20-mile radius is really what impacts our sales. 52% of our sales come out of the greater metropolitan Portland area. A casino within 15 miles of downtown Portland will have an impact. How much? I cannot tell you. Same thing for the Portland Private Casino. They barely missed the November ballot. They are curiously silent right now, I think only because you are in session. But I think they are legally prepared to gather signatures, and obviously a Portland Casino would have an impact. Last thing I'll quickly say, because you may see a bill on this, Senate Bill 69. When I talk about traditional sales, tickets, Keno, Megabucks, those types of things, if you go in and buy a ticket, you'll see a little red machine. That's a 10-year-old computer. We are in the process. We've gone through an RFP. We will be replacing that technology, and quite frankly, it's way behind the time. We hope that that will help us grow our traditional product. It's kind of like we're going from a Commodore 64 to a new, you know, quad processor or something. But that is an opportunity for us. And actually, the cost of technology has gone down, so we'll actually save money in our contract for that technology. But we are, by statute, required to have a warm site in Burns, within 10 miles of the center of Burns. We have worked with the tribe and with the county, and we believe that there is support for a consortium in the Burns area to buy the building that is shared between DAS and the lottery. With a new contract on our traditional system, they give us the opportunity to have our vendor provide backup services with their IT capability at a very minimal cost. Right now, it costs us somewhere close to $250,000 a year to have this Burns capability, just to have the capability, so that if we had to, if Salem shut down, we could move to Burns and operate. But that's money that we believe we can save if we have legislative permission. We would only move this bill if there was local support for it. I will know in the next month or so if that's going to happen. Last thing I'll say real quickly, Mr. Chair, I apologize if I've gone over. I mentioned before earlier that problem gambling and responsible gambling are very important messages for us. This last page talks about this. Last session, the legislature did allocate the entire 1% for problem gambling treatment. That was very helpful. They were able to expand their treatments, and by the way, the lottery has nothing to do with treatment itself. That's handled by DHS. However, we do involve their program managers in consulting with us on our products and how we market and how we present our products. We also provide the public affairs information about the 1-800 number. They would not have any publicity about the 1-800 number without the lottery. And so we give that information so that it advertises that number. We have placed the 1-800 number on every one of our VLTs throughout the state, and we've tried to do some other things. And for those 97% that are not at risk as problem gamblers, we try to give the message of responsible gambling, set a budget, set a time limit, have fun. So even though lottery is really part of this issue, there are casinos, there's the internet gambling, there's illegal gambling, and certainly lottery is part of problem gambling. But I think Origin can be proud that at least of all of the gambling activities out there, Oregon is trying to make a difference for those who do have a problem with it. So that's my overview, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. If there's any questions you might have, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Penn. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Penn, I have a question about your statement, your comment that smoking, anti-smoking ordinances have impacted your sales. Do you have proof of that? Do you have data to show me? Because my community of Eugene has a no smoking ordinance, and I'd like to see the numbers on that. Do you have numbers?
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, let me say what my statement, or what I meant to say. Maybe I didn't say it correctly. I simply said, here are some issues, and I'm not trying to make a policy argument at all. The governor strongly supports a ban. The lottery must be neutral on the policy issue. However, I simply make the note that smoking will have some impact. I can't tell you how much. I can't tell you for how long. That is a great matter of debate nationally. voters have done this in many other states, and right now in Nevada and New Jersey, there will be the issue of whether or not it will be extended to the casino floors. But I know in Canada there has been some issues. In Eugene, I can give you some old data, there was a temporary, for some period of time, some loss in revenue in Eugene. I don't see it as a major issue. I just make the note that this forecast is pushing us to the point that we're going to have to work very hard to get this forecast. I believe we will, and it is doable, and you can rely upon it. But I just identified here some things that will be a downward pull, at least for some period of time. That's the reason for it.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Yes, if you have any data, I would appreciate that you would provide that to me.
Sure.
I'm now writing a column for our alternative weekly newspaper in Eugene, and I'd like to talk about this issue.
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Burke and Senator Brown.
If I could follow up on the same point, I think the most useful data would be from perhaps other states that had a statewide ban, because if you have a community ban, then it's reasonable to assume that people can go elsewhere. But if it's statewide, I think that would be the most useful data to have.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Burry, that's one of the real difficulties. This is a, you know, a localized situation, and it was temporary. It really doesn't provide any benefit other than it'll have some impact. It may just be temporary, a few weeks, but that's kind of where it's been.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three quick questions. Mr. Penn, page 9, you talked about the contingency reserve containing $45 million in cash. I didn't catch who sets that dollar amount, and how is it determined?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, the Lottery Commission sets that amount, and as I said, the $20 million is really liquid capability to pay bills.
Okay.
So what it really comes down to is, as our sales allow us, we are still going to make the transfer rate to make that forecast. And this simply allows us to accumulate up to $25 million as a reserve fund. Now, here it talks about annually, we will review that. When we close the books at the end of the fiscal year, anything that's over that is automatically transferred at that time. So it's really kind of a timing issue as a reserve fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any follow-ups? On page 11, and this is actually more of a comment than a question, I noted that you exceeded your 07-09 benchmarks or targets in just about every category, and I guess my encouragement would be it's probably time to revise or update your targeted figures if you're exceeding them, which you are. So good job. Now I want to see you do better. And on the last page, page 14, Mr. Chair, if I may, I don't have a sense of whether or not 1% meets the needs of our gaming treatment, and I guess the question I'd ask, does 1% meet 50% of the need, 20% of the need, or 110% of the need? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I know that DHS is better. Jeff Murata is the clinical psychologist in charge of that program, and at least I've heard him speak in the past that they just were able to move to bring in patient treatment capability. But I think what he would tell you is they are now, they have built the infrastructure that they may be able to use more than 1%. Up until this year, I think he would have said 1% is sufficient, but he is the expert on that and could advise you about it. Jeff Murata from DHS.
So you don't have a sense of, you know, whether we're meeting a very small percentage of the need or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I believe that only a small percent actually ask for help.
Okay.
And that's why the lottery's help in at least getting the message out there is very important. But you have to be willing to say, I'm willing to accept that I have a problem. That's the real difficulty.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Penn, for your testimony. Just one question to follow up Senator Brown's point on the treatment programs. Are the Indian casinos contributing at all to the treatment fund in our state? Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I don't know, and I'm really outside my area.
Okay.
Other questions?
One quick one.
What's on that? Go, Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. Mr. Penn, I'm looking at the graph you gave us on page 12, and you've talked about your capacity to lower the commissions. But as I calculate those numbers, you said that you were expecting a 25% increase in sales, and you actually saw a 40% increase, allowing a 1% change in the commission. Did the retailers incur any additional expense to provide that level of sale?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, this 25% is the rate, the blended average, in the present contract. And so what you're seeing with the 24% is really just the natural downturn because our rates decrease the more that sales go. But then I mentioned that the look back, however, in June 2007 would establish the 23%. So I anticipate that's going to happen this summer. So now I don't know if I've answered your question or not. Oh, so do they have other costs?
Additional costs.
I know that retailers, their position would be that as business increases, then they add staff, they would have staff costs. But I can't detail for you all of those things. But they also, unfortunately, we've had the situation, certainly in the last several weeks, we've had a number of armed robberies in the Portland area where they've targeted video retailers and insurance costs. We have landlords who have now keyed into this idea and demand a percentage of revenue as part of their lease, and it gets very complicated. So retailers would tell you, yes, their costs go up, and those are the ones that I recall most clear.
Just a quick observation, Mr. Co-Chair.
Please.
If you were projecting 25% increases at a blended commission of 25%, my calculation says that that's about 31% increase in retention for the retailers on a composite basis. But even if it went down to 24% blended commissions, if that's on a 40% higher base, they reaped almost 35%. So that's a 4% better just for sitting still. Not bad. Not bad for them.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, we have tracked what is the gross amount of commissions that we've actually paid. And we did pay about $20 million additional commissions this past year in this record year of sales. So the percentage did drop, but the goal there, at least, was not to put people out of business. And we didn't put people out of business, and some of them made some more, but not excessively more. But it was $20
million.
Thank
you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, point of clarification. Mr. Penn, is it correct to say then that the diminished commission rates are a function of greater economies of scale?
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, no, I'm giving you my sales pitch to the retailers on why they should continue to sell our product, that they aren't going to be hurt. This was a process that started out as an administrative rulemaking thing, started at 35%, and it has been, particularly in the last 3.5 years, changed dramatically in that time. But,
Mr. Chair, follow up,
please.
Are there any other states that have adopted this model?
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, it's very controversial. The other states that have video, they actually have a higher amount for retailers than we do. We have the smallest in the United States. However, the argument goes that Canada is the appropriate model because Canada owns their machines as Oregon does. In these other states, the state does not own the machine. And in Canada, the rates are between 15 and 22. That's why I brought that up.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
So if I may cut to the chase, what's the ability of the legislature to set the rates for the lotteries?
Mr. Chair, that's very problematic. We have a contract that is signed until 2010. I think legally we would have major problems. I actually got sued, and I'm still in Marion County Court right now, by one of the retailers when we changed line games and dropped it down to 25. I think we'll be successful in that suit. But I think legislative action at this point, without something else in the contract, we would have a very difficult problem. 2010, though, does present an opportunity, and clearly we have already begun the process at looking at other jurisdictions. What do they do? What is the process? There's a Court of Appeals decision right now where the 2004 original contract was invalidated by the Court of Appeals. I expect that will be appeal to the Supreme Court. There's a lot of variety of issues there, and that only applies to 70 retailers right now. I think the intent of the people who brought the lawsuit is to say in 2010 this should be something that's looked at. The difficulty is you may see legislation saying this phrase, reasonable rate of return for retailers. That's the phrase in the statute, and perhaps asking to strike that from the legislation, because the Court of Appeals said, we don't think that the commission in 2004 really looked at reasonable rate of return as that is defined, as the court defined it. We also think that may be impossible to have a rate of return for 2,200 individual retailers with different rents, all kinds of things. But that's not our problem. That's for the legislature to deal with. So that whole issue of perhaps changing that standard would probably be very helpful, but in 2010 there is a real opportunity to look at other issues, whether it's bidding or what it is.
And absent a change in statute, we have no control over that rate, is that correct?
That is one legal interpretation. I never like to tell the legislature they can't do something, but that could be a constitutional issue. Yes.
The last comment I guess I'd make for the group as a whole, speaking about lottery in general, I think if you look at the LFO analysis of our lottery revenues, that you should keep in mind that 51% of that, or 50%, is dedicated revenues. So while it's been a growing source, and we've heard today and others that it's now probably line games have been ratcheted in, we're worried about even making our forecast. And on top of that, between last session and this coming session, our trend is to dedicate another or obligate another 25% of the unobligated monies. And I would remind everyone that remaining 75% of the 50% is schools. Historically, this body has always used that to backfill the K-12 budget. So the idea that lottery money is free money that we can just use, because we got all this we haven't used yet, keep a good eye on your K-12 budget when you talk about that sort of thing, dedicating more and more. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity. Good presentation. And last but not least, we want to hear about how much money we're saving with Scenic. So I wonder who the lucky person is or Lindsay. Please come forward, sir. Mr. Rawl. Good to see you. Please proceed. Thank you for being here.
Not a problem. Chair Schrader, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Chair Schrader, I can speak to the Scenic project. What I was requested to talk about today specifically was the reorganization of the Information Resource Management Division.
Stay on task, everybody.
I do have a short summary of Scenic at the conclusion of the major projects, and Scenic is included there. I was asked to come and speak and present to you the reasons why we consolidated, but reorganized the Information Resource Management Division, which was the central entity in state government where we provided services to agencies with information technology resources in the state. And as I did a management review of the Information Resource Management Division shortly after I came to DAS in January of 2000, six, I came to the conclusion that, one, there wasn't anyone that I could talk to that knew for sure when IRMD was formed. Late 80s, early 90s is the approximate time frame as to when it was created. And it was created at a time, we found, when there were not as many technically skilled people in agencies as there are today. And I think Oregon is blessed with a very robust, skilled workforce in information technology. I think a lot of that is attributed to the fact that there's a lot of IT industry in the state, besides Oregon being Oregon and people wanting to be here. But at any rate, today we have a lot of highly skilled people, technically skilled people in state government, unlike what we had in the early 90s and late 80s. In addition to that, we also discovered that in the early 80s and 90s, when that division was created and the services were needed, we were writing programs in state government specific to agencies' needs, programs which you can buy off the shelf today. And so there were staff on hand that weren't in need today as there were in the late 80s, early 90s. In conjunction with that, having looked at that in and of itself, the business model for IRMD didn't fit as it did at one time. And so that, along with looking at the project office of IRMD, which was the contracting services to agencies for IT projects, we evaluated the cost associated with DAS contracting with state agencies, where we were charging nearly $100 an hour, recognizing that private industry could provide those same services for less money, plus the fact that we had trained agencies to manage projects, IT projects at their level. We couldn't see the sense in continuing on with that function of IRMD either. And so we reorganized IRMD and created the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division. With that reorganization, there's about a $2 million savings to the agency. And the Enterprise Strategy and Information Policy Division is going to focus more on the statewide aspects of IT management. And I'll give you some examples. In the interest of time, we'll try to move as quickly as possible, Chair. Electronic government. How do we, in the state of Oregon, consolidate and coordinate e-government? And e-government can be all the way from permit processes to people wanting information, etc. Enterprise Security Office. How do we provide an enterprise security network for the state of Oregon and still allow agencies to have the flexibility within their own resources to still function? Business continuity planning. If there's a disaster, a large disaster like natural or man-made disaster or something less than that, how do we continue the service of IT and information sharing that needs to go on and maintain the state's business on an enterprise base? Geospatial information systems. Today we have pools of information at the city, county, state, and federal levels, and that information in the GIS system are independent of one another. I would like to pool that information into one resource so that we can have it available to everyone to use, and we currently, as a matter of fact, have a policy option package in our budget at DAS to do that. IT investment and planning. How do we best invest IT management in the state of Oregon, getting the most out of our investment? Example. Currently, we're working with Oregon Department of Transportation on a human resource information system. That is an issue for the state of Oregon. Our human resource information system is antiquated. It's almost a paper file system, one step above. But agencies can't access it. I wasn't prepared to move forward on a statewide enterprise base for a human resource information system, but ODOT was wanting to start moving forward internally in their agency. We came up with an agreement with the ODOT director and his staff to allow them to move forward with their project under the guidelines from an enterprise base they're kind of blazing the trail for us a little bit here, so that in a couple of years we can come forth with a statewide enterprise human resource information system. I would take any questions about the reorganization of IRMD at this time, if anyone should have one, or I can move straight into some of the larger projects, FIT projects that we're monitoring at this time.
Question? Seeing none, go ahead.
Currently, we are drawing to closure the scenic project. I think everyone in this room has probably heard some of the difficulties associated with scenic. The consolidation of the 12 data of the 12 agencies into one data center is nearly complete. It was fraught early on with some poor planning, lack of a program manager at the front end rather than hiring him after the legislation was approved, and then everyone discovering that the planning process was flawed. In January, shortly after I went to DAS, I identified some of the issues and concerns with data center that I had heard. I shared those same concerns, and we came together with the governing board and refocused the staffing levels of the data center as well as the financial model. We went to the GLC-IMT, gave a presentation of our recommended changes to that committee, went to the APOE board, and gave our presentation to them as well. It was approved. We were allowed to add staff to the data center so it would be successful. And we also revised the financial model that it was built on. You will see savings from the data center, but they will be out one more biennium than what originally thought. We thought there would be savings realized by 2009-11. That won't happen until 2011-13. So we're one biennium off on the savings to be accrued from the data center. However, without the necessary changes that we implemented, I don't think that center would have been successfully implemented. It will be today. I'm not as concerned about it as I once was. There were a lot of lessons learned from that that project. I hope that they aren't repeated in the near future.
You're speaking about Owen?
I can speak about Owen.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going ahead.
Owen, I feel better about Owen today. I was asked by the governor's office to provide administrative oversight of the Owen project in June of this year. First thing I asked was, do we have a program manager? Well, the legislation was passed, and we hadn't hired a program manager again. And so I said, well, the first thing we're going to do is hire a program manager. And so we hired a program manager in September. We had a contract out with a private firm by the name of Federal Engineering to provide an analysis of the state system that we currently have and costs associated with that. Their first calculation on cost was $905 million. I was somewhat taken back by that, as was a few other people. I asked that let's look at another estimate of the cost associated with that under some different parameters. They delivered a product the 1st of November at $665 million, which is a base that we are working from today. There are costs associated with Owen projects in other states that far exceed $1 billion, up to $2 billion. Currently, what I've directed Owen staff, the program manager and associate staff to do is that we're going to hire a project analyst, because I want to break down the $665 million cost figure to analyze exactly what it is we're going to be investing in Oregon and the benefits associated with that money. And my vision is that will be done on a Owen backbone piece. in Northeast, Oregon, the Mid-Columbia, the I-5 corridor, the 97 corridor, the coast, etc. Exact dimensions of those plans have not been identified yet. That will be the job and task of the project analyst. But I want more of an analytical sense as to what it is we'll be buying and the benefits associated with it, so that we don't come asking for an investment by this body and not be able to tell you what it's going to do for the people of Oregon. I don't want to revisit scenic. I think we can do a better job than that.
Thank you,
I mentioned the HRIS project. I also mentioned geospatial. I'll conclude by stating that there, in the last year that I've been at DAS, there have been a lot of changes in the IT environment. Some challenges, too. And I think you're going to find more change is going to come in the future as we start to be more progressive in this area. With that, I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? Thank you, Royal Few, for remaining to the end. Thank you, Lindsay, for your tolerance and patience with us all. We wish you a lot of luck and some good discussions, I think, during the legislative session. Appreciate your leadership.
Thank you.
Thanks.
With that, we are